This is Great FM, a podcast series by Great HR. Produced by Timber Media.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Great FM. Mahalia here, your host. And as we find ourselves in the midst of Pride Month, it's important for us to acknowledge everything that this month brings with it. You know, there is, of course, a visible surge of support. There's rainbow logos all over the place, campaigns and conversations that signal inclusion. And while all of these are steps in the right direction, beyond the symbolism, I think lies a harder and more important question that needs to be answered. And that is, do people actually feel like they belong at work? You know, when you look at diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, diversity is easy to measure. Inclusion, a little bit harder. And belonging, that is a deeply personal human experience that is often invisible and shaped in the moments that don't really make it into reports, right? Because how do you quantify belonging? When we talk about belonging, we're talking about who gets heard in meetings, who gets, you know, opportunities, and who feels safe enough to show up fully as their authentic self. So today, as organizations become more data-driven, there is this risk of mistaking metrics and numbers for meaning. So as we honor Pride Month on Great FM, in this episode, we're asking what it really takes to move beyond counting diversity to really creating cultures of genuine belonging. You know, what shifts do leaders have to make and what belonging should really look like? It's a nuanced and complex conversation, and that just means that it has to be had. So helping us with that is Harsha Bhosle, Director HR Programs Oracle, who brings with her a wealth of experience from the DEIB space as well. Welcome, Harsha. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you so much. This is not just a topic. This is not just a word. Belonging. Belonging means being in many, many places, yet feeling that you are there. Right, that is what it means. For each person, it means something else. To me, it feels like, you know, you're being in a room full of people, yet you feel like yourself, being different, yet accepted. That's what belonging means to me, right? And I must tell you that at different stages of your life, you feel different. Mm-hmm. And while you're accepted being different at different stages of your life, it feels being valued. I'm just extremely excited to be here today and be having this conversation with you. So thank you again.
Oh, thanks so much, Harsha. You know, but this is the thing. You brought up two words, acceptance and feeling valued, right? And I think it's incredible the role that HR and HR teams can really play in enabling that. And I'd like to start with the basics. You know, organizations have become very good at measuring diversity, but I personally feel that there is quite a large gap between representation metrics and actual employee experience, because that little detail that you mentioned, you know, being different but feeling accepted, that is such an important part of this conversation. So can you talk to us about where you really see that gap between representation and actual employee experience?
That is such a great question. I must say this, that being fortunate, being among great organizations in the last almost 22 years, it has given me this wealth of learning opportunity where I've gotten to learn that organizations have been extremely good at counting, really, you know. Mm-hmm. They are good at counting gender ratios, as we call it, diversity percentages in hiring reports. So they are good at those dashboards. But when there comes a moment when someone walks into the door, the metric actually stops. What happens to that person on day one in their first performance review when they are passed over to that stretch project, that very important assignment? That's where the actual gap lives. In my work across different continents, and fortunately so in JPAC and even in EMEA now, I've seen that organizations hit their diversity hiring targets and still have, you know, people of different genders, say, mm-hmm. for example, women leaving at higher rate than men. The representation looked good on paper, but the experience told a very different story. So I feel that we need to measure belonging not just the head count.
Right.
Right. So is there a way that we do that? It is in the feelers that we get around the floor in the team, and what really happens, what really hits at the end of the year. How do people actually feel at the end of the year and not just the numbers that show up on the dashboard?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it has been very interesting to see HR teams and people professionals become more attuned to the experiential, subjective, and emotional needs of employees within the workplace, because that just means that the very metrics that you're using to measure success in these areas are changing as well, right? So the things that you're paying attention to have to change. And I think an important caveat, with this conversation is, of course, that while Pride Month brings with it all of these great conversations and steps in the right direction, we also, I think, and it's been a point of critique quite often, see a fair amount of rainbow washing and the like, right? What are some of the most common ways organizations you think unintentionally confuse inclusion efforts with just performative actions? And honestly, when it comes to performative actions, once you perform them, they're done, right? There's nowhere else it can go. So, where do you think that slip up usually comes up for a lot of teams?
It is again another great point that you bring in, and that also makes me feel that there is so much more education that needs to prevail in our world, everywhere. It's not just in the organizations, but in the world in general. And that will help us not only just understand these terms, because they just don't belong to boardrooms and, in the hallways of office buildings. They actually belong to our everydays. They will not just bring in civic sense, but they will bring in a little more sense into our lives. So I must say this, I have sat in rooms where the logo turned rainbow in June and went back to gray in July, and
Right.
nothing else changed after that, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, in any color for that matter, right? So the most common trap I see in event-led inclusion, in quotes, but one panel, one awareness day, one campaign, or one speaker at a time is not going to change anything, right? So inclusion isn't a moment. Somebody saying something or preaching you something isn't a muscle. It is something that needs to prevail, right? At one of the companies that I worked with, they were extremely deliberate about not letting pride or any other awareness moment stand alone. It was something that had to connect structurally. It had to be a leadership commitment, a mentoring commitment, even a data. I wouldn't like the word target, but a data commitment in some sort.
Yeah.
We were accountable for this accountability. Maybe that's a better word, right? So the question I always ask, and we all must pertinently ask, is what changes on July 1st after the Pride Month is over, which wasn't true on 31st of May,
Yes.
right? So if the answer is nothing, then it was just performative. It was not true to what you were trying to actually achieve. So, yes, I mean, this term would mean nothing if it is not in your everyday actions.
Yeah, absolutely. And it leads me to dive deeper into that juxtaposition that you mentioned, right? Which is there's all of this data to suggest that we're progressing in the right direction, but people's experience and actions are not necessarily always aligning with that data. And I think a lot of it eventually, when you talk about traditional organizations and the world we live in, most organizations are traditionally structured. It does tend to move top down, right? So leaders play a huge role in enabling belonging in the true sense. And I think, if I were to ask you what mindset shifts you think leaders need to make to move from really just managing diversity, quantifying it, to actually enabling belonging, what would you pinpoint it to be?
I'm going to say something which might not sound extremely good to the ears, but I have to say this, that only if you say the word diversity, managing diversity is a transactional act. You are actually solving a compliance problem if you're going by the numbers, right? So enabling belonging is actually relational and is the real problem that you're planning to solve or the real world issue, really, because you're asking whether every person on your team can bring their complete self, like I started this conversation with, right? When they bring their complete authentic self to work, they will contribute their best self. So there is a difference between a transaction and the real problem that you're trying to, relational issue that you're trying to resolve here, right? And this shift, I have seen and I have experienced when the best leaders are moving their mindset from, do we have enough representation, to saying that, does everyone here feel the same way? Does everyone feel that this matters or not? And I can say this, that at a couple of companies that I worked for, you know, the leaders who made the biggest impact weren't the ones who actually attended D&I trainings. They actually were the ones who changed how they even made small micro changes, even in their Monday meetings and how they conducted them. Right? Who they actually called on as the first person on their meetings, whose ideas they valued, who did they credit in their, how did they do it, who they sponsored when a role opened. That's the real mindset shift. So yes, I think that's what I would say.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the risk of oversimplifying it, sometimes I think it just comes down to actions do speak louder than words, and policies and things like that are just words at the end of the day. But the people implementing these policies and the way that they behave really speaks volumes, right? When you look at the overall picture. But this is also where it gets a bit complicated, Harsha, because as you mentioned, a lot of this data is derived from things like hiring practices, promotions, project allocation, and things like that, right? These are very tangible ways and processes in which or from which you can derive data that signals progress, yes? But at the same time, it may just boil down to only data. So I want to get your opinion on whether these everyday decisions are just as important as the overall actions and behaviors within a company, and whether they really do signal inclusion and are as necessary as they've been made out to be.
Absolutely, absolutely. I would say that this actually signal it much more louder than any policy document, right? I would not undermine a policy document because they're derived from many micro decisions, experiences. But who gets the high visibility project? Who gets the benefit of the doubt in a performance or career conversation? Who's invited into the room before the decision is made, right? I have seen incredibly well-written inclusion policies exist in organizations where the same three profiles keep getting promoted, you know? So employees aren't actually reading your policy, they are watching what you do in your decisions. And I'm saying, I'm not undermining any policies being written. There is a lot of very accomplished people who are putting those policies together, but employees may not be completely going and reading word by word in it. But what they are doing is, why did you put that policy together? What decision drove you to make that policy, right? And they are also very good at reading the pattern of how you move those policies around. They could be in any respect, right? Even if it is with respect to benefits, compensation, insurance, work from home, or anything that benefits you in a long run. So it is their everyday decisions which, you know, collectively make inclusion real for people in general.
Absolutely. And I really do appreciate, Harsha, you know, the experiential sort of lens that you have brought to the conversation so far. And I'd like to dig into that a little bit more because I think people do learn from real life examples a lot better than they do from theoretical conversation. So can you maybe share some examples of these micro moments, micro behavioral changes that you were talking about at work that either will build or then break a sense of belonging, things that you've seen play out both positively and negatively?
Sure. I think it's interesting enough that I can give you two real ones. We hosted a leadership dialogue with very accomplished people like, say, Vishwanathan Anand here in my current organization for our early career hires. And the signal that you belong in this conversation is somebody not just habitually or maliciously or consistently is interrupting a conversation while you are speaking about it. I've also seen manager consistently stop people in midway conversations in a team meeting. And it might become a habit, but within a few months, I've seen somebody stopping speaking up entirely. There was no policy that caused that, no policy that fixed it either, but a conversation with that one person had done that. So I'm talking about two different scenarios where micro moments can break or build belonging. In the first one, where we were able to host a whole big dialogue with something which was unreal, we did not know that we could do it, and we were able to bring somebody extremely accomplished in front of a set of participants, and they were able to ask him direct questions. And exactly in the opposite side, where somebody absolutely was not able to have a proper conversation in a team meeting, which should have been a very, very consistent environment, a very real, safe environment. So I can tell you that micro moments can definitely do that to people.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really interesting how the same micro behavior, rather, can either build or break given the context of a situation, right? Harsha, just to pivot a little bit. Now, say an HR team is at the table, they've been tasked with coming up with policies, amending policies or processes towards increasing inclusion and making it more genuine, right? It's not just about fairness, but it's about enabling this genuine inclusion and belonging through policies and processes. What would be your advice to HR teams? Would you suggest that they have to rethink certain ways that they look at these processes and policies? Or, overall, what are your thoughts there?
Since you said that maybe I could give some specific examples, I could do that. I would start by saying that fairness is giving everyone the same thing, right? Inclusion is giving people what they need, what they actually need. So there was this one time when I built a program at EY for women returning from career breaks. I was very privileged to actually build that program from scratch. And, the fair policy would have been to put them through the same hiring process as everyone else. The inclusive policy would have been to redesign the process to account for the whole gap. Different interviewing process, framing, structural ramp-up period, dedicated buddies, and policies should have been rewritten and with all of the edges in mind, right? But who does this policy actually work for? Who does this quietly leave out? And that's the question that HR needs to ask before publishing anything. So I would say rethinking policy and inclusion and fairness are three different words on the same page. So this is an excellent example of HR rethinking policies and not changing the policy in itself. So structural ramp up of the whole recruiting process for this particular program was not required. Thinking differently to put this program together was something that was required in this instance. So yes, they need to think differently.
Yeah, that's a valid distinction that you've made. And we spoke a little bit earlier in the conversation about the role that leadership plays when it comes to translating organizational intent into lived employee experience, right? But I also like to take a look at the manager's role in this. When we talk about leaders, we usually, I think, in all of our heads, are thinking of the C-suite, right? Or the highest level leaders. But managers who are leaders in their own right play a very important role, especially in the everyday action of things, right? So, where do you think they typically fall short when it comes to translating or communicating this organizational intent into lived employee experience?
There are very mixed opinions that people and everybody else may have. I do have one myself, and the way I have experienced it is the managers somehow at the last mile of every inclusion strategy put into that, and also is somewhere very under supported in many ways, because it looks like and it feels like that inclusion is a strategy and is the top leadership's problem. Organizations invest in leadership buy-in at the top and employee programs at the bottom. So the managers are always somewhere in the middle, and they are just somehow handed a policy deck and expected to figure it out. So that's why I said that they are somewhere the last mile of the inclusion strategy. And strategy somehow becomes a word which is a very aligned to leadership. So what I have seen, the work that is making inclusion part of how managers are evaluated is it is not a side initiative. At Caterpillar, one of the companies that I worked with, when we started tying diversity outcomes to managers' scorecards, conversation actually completely changed, right? So suddenly managers wanted the toolkit, wanted the training, and the intent actually followed accountability. So this scorecard actually was cascaded down through the top leadership. So things change when you change accountability standards. The managers, they do not intend to be put somewhere in the middle and handed, like I said, just a few documents. They may be intentional to do something. It is not the assumption that follows the route. It should be the accountability that really should follow the intent always follows accountability. So yes, that is how I have at least seen in a few organizations that I worked with.
No, and I'm really so appreciative of all of these examples that you're giving us because they're very rich in context and in nuance and complexity as well, Harsha. And as we come to the end of this wonderful conversation, I think it's only right that we leave our listeners with some very practical, actionable tips, right, on how they can really move from intent to actual impact where it gets felt in the everyday experience. So I'll leave the floor open to you if you could just run through some practical everyday practices that HR professionals and teams can start implementing immediately.
That's interesting enough. So, three things that I would start my week, if I have to say that. I think one structured meeting, actively ensure that quieter voices are heard, basically, the people who do not talk much. So, in every meeting, call those people out. Not putting them on the spot, but do something that, brings their voice out in a very calmer, nicer, appreciative way. The second one is blind resume reviews for internal promotions, right? People who are internally working, and today is the world of so much fungible skills and people upskilling themselves and working to move in different directions, not just elevating themselves, but moving laterally. And we are moving in that world so rapidly. Very important to promote internally. Create processes that build your internal promotability in organizations, not always just external hiring, which helps the organizations to become richer internally. That way, even external hiring will become extremely richer. Your own promotion bias actually is much more and many times often stronger than your own hiring bias. And this is what I have experienced, right? And the third thing, which is in my experience, I've seen is that if you do belonging check-ins, that means not just, hey, how is your work doing today? But how do you feel seen here, right? How do you feel your contributions matter? It takes 2 minutes, and the data it surfaces is more honest than the engagement survey. Engagement survey might have 26 and 86 questions, but they are habits. They are not programs and surveys. Your habits are stronger than the surveys and a million questions because habits build the culture, and your culture is made of your habits. So definitely important, and I think those things will take you a long way. So yeah, that's what I think.
That's a rich list, Harsha, and I don't think we could have ended the conversation on a brighter, more hopeful note. Thank you so much for all of your insights. And, this is a conversation that carries with it a lot of nuance and complexity. And I think we've really benefited from your nuanced approach. So thank you so much for being here and for helping us unpack all of this. It's been a lovely, lovely time with you today.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a good day.
All right. Well, that's a wrap on this episode of Great FM. For all of you HR professionals out there who've tuned in today, I hope you've really taken down copious notes because this conversation was the perfect balance between, the practical and the experiential, right? So we'll catch you on the next one very soon. Thank you and wishing everyone a very happy Pride Month.
This is Great FM, a podcast series by Great HR, produced by Timber Media.